Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, before we get started, I wanted to let you know about an upcoming Architecture on Stage event you might be interested in. At the Barbican Concert Hall this Friday, that's February 26th, the Architecture Foundation is inviting leading architects and housing experts to set out their vision for a renaissance of public housing. Chaired by former Peabody Development Director Claire Benny, panelists include Pooja Agrawal, Melis Howard, Paul Karakusevich, Adam Kahn, Osama Shush, Joseph Zeal Henry, Russell Curtis, and Astrid Smitham, who you'll be hearing more from in a minute. To find out more about the talk and to book your tickets, follow the link in the show notes, and I hope to see you there. All right, now into the show. From the Architecture Foundation, I'm Matthew Blunderfield, and you're listening to Scaffold. In this episode, I speak with Nicholas Lobo Brennan and Astrid Smitham of Apparata, a London-based architecture practice that's been thrust into the spotlight this past year following the completion of their experimental housing project, A House for Artists. Nick and Astrid established Apparata in 2014, have taught together at the Royal College of Art, and currently run a design studio at the Kingston School of Art in London. Before setting up practice, Astrid was briefly a screenwriter in Berlin, and Nick worked for Peter Zumthor in Switzerland and Florian Bagel's Architecture Research Unit in London, as well as teaching with Tom Emerson at ETH, where he helped establish the studio's live build projects. Nick also co-founded a practice called Grupa in 2011. Until recently, Apparata's work focused mostly on subtle refurbishments of existing buildings, including the Old Manor Park Library in Newham and the White House in Dagenham, two projects commissioned by the nonprofit Create London. A House for Artists, also commissioned in part by Create, marks a real departure, though. Instead of adapting existing structures, the project proposes a model of housing that feels radical and new to London, in terms of the social life it makes possible between neighbors, as well as the public life it invites into its ground floor. This interview is a little different than usual. Instead of tracing the entire arc of Nick and Astrid's practice, we really focus on this one project, its urban context, and the ideas embedded in the building itself, which we visited together last week on a brisk January afternoon. I met Nick and Astrid outside Barking Station, which is where the interview begins.
Just to kind of situate us, we've just left the Costa Coffee across from Barking Station. I'm with Nick and Astrid, and we're on our way to a house for artists. And we're warming up.
It's like being the beginning of Star Trek episodes. Stardate 24.
I think it's interesting to start recording here because
yeah, I like that.
You talk a lot, both of you, when you talk about the building, about the route to the front door. And in a way, it begins on the street. So to talk about this building, this specific project, really is to talk about this part of Barking, this part of the city.
Yeah, I think we always like to meet people at the station, not right at the building. So that way we can see the high street, usually a market.
Sorry, should we go this
way? Yeah, let's cross here.
Mm-hmm. You two must have done this walk thousands of times by now.
We know all the good places for lunch.
Uh-huh. What stands out to you on your way to the site? What are you fond of?
There's no empty shops for a start. It's like a really lively high street with loads and loads of independent shops. I don't know if it's like London from 20 years ago or something that's where it feels like a lot is still possible. No, what do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I agree. I think it feels like a high street. It doesn't feel like there aren't so many London high streets left with this character anymore.
Right.
So down here, there's a market that's several times a week. You can get whatever. You can basically, you don't have to leave the high street almost. You can get whatever you want in the high street.
This is incredible. And I know what you mean, though. It's like there's not yet that sense of a corporate monoculture.
Yeah.
And the street is not sanitized and sterile.
Yeah.
And it's bustling with all kinds of people.
It's extremely successful. Like, there's only a few other high streets I can think of like this still in London. It makes me a little bit nostalgic, like the London my childhood or something.
And to compound that the sun is kind of hanging low in the sky now. It's around 2:30 or 3 o'clock. It's almost golden hour. There is a real kind of lambent nostalgia in the atmosphere right now.
There is, yeah. I think everyone's happy it's Friday.
Yes.
And then this goes down to the river. Where there's the Barking Abbey, which is one of the former centres of British power, you know, 1,000 years ago. And the way we go is this way. And here, like, actually from here is interesting, you can really see the history of British development. You get those kind of 2-3 rise developments from, I don't know, the early 20th century. And you get these kind of 60s, 70s, quite handsome blocks, and then you get these newer towers with their sort of paper-thin facades.
I mean, all of these didn't exist when we started the project, so they're really new. And one building has been demolished, which...
Although, weirdly, we knew they were coming because when we started the probe on the competition, we saw they had this master planning model that showed Barking with very many towers that weren't there yet. Right. And so we knew that was the kind of context... hadn't been built yet.
And just to situate us now, we're standing at this, in this square, this intersection. What is it called?
Station Parade.
Station Parade.
And Linton Road is this one.
Completely. And then just down the road, just around the corner, there's the Muff Ruin. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but a fantastic project. Made this kind of pseudo ruin, and that's just next to a large HMM development. So yeah, there's and also just nearby there's a Peter Barber. There's two Peter Barbers. So Barking Central has been quite supportive of architects in many ways.
We're approaching the project now, which is very demurely revealing itself as we get closer. It's kind of sandwiched in between two other projects.
The idea is it comes from, it's like part of a parade of buildings, largely public, that come from the Market Street down to the estate. The estate here used to be a kind of very typical post-war figure ground estate. It was deemed to have failed and it was knocked down. Debates as to whether it should be knocked down or not, but what they put in its place was this kind of urbanism based on streets from the last 20 years. And the site is the leftover site of the construction office. And the idea is that when you first come across it, it has more the character of a public building than, say, housing. I think there's an ongoing debate in London about what should housing look like? Housing, what does housing look like? And for this, we were kind of saying, no, this is really, it needs to have a kind of presence of a public building. One because it is a public building on the ground floor and serves the public, but also in light of having these towers appearing around it, it needs to have a certain ability to stand against those. There's a very nice drawing by Lina Bobardi, hand biro drawing that she does of the Cesc Pompeia squat tower, and she has all these extremely tall towers drawn around behind it, and there's a note saying there's this kind of future of towers coming and this little building has to be able to withstand it. Should we go over here and then maybe we'll keep it quite brief, right? So we'll just go over there so you can see the other side, and then we'll have a look from here and go in, and then we'll go upstairs.
So we're just passing by the kind of front facing loggia, call it?
Yeah.
The deeper balcony, which is also the deck access. And we're passing by the ground floor workshop space, or artist space.
So this is a public art space at the front, and the artists contribute to running a public program there for the local community. So has a huge number of different events, like after school clubs or coffee mornings or games nights, also drawing workshops. So it's not that the artists have to practice their art there in terms of the workshops, but whatever they find out from the community is needed.
Mm-hmm. And part of the agreement was, in exchange for a reduced rent,
They
offer back some public program in this ground floor space.
Yeah.
Half a day a week.
Roughly. But we wanted that public space to feel like it's capturing a piece of the street, with quite a low threshold to entry, so you can see what's going on in quite a light way and then decide whether to go in or not. So no lobby or forecourt or...
Because the reason being is culture institutions have a sort of literal problem with the threshold entry. Like if the entrance to culture institution is too far away from, say, the street edge, it can be an intimidating thing to approach. Mm-hmm. So the idea is it's just a kind of, catch the street. So just to say, it's this thing talking about it, having a kind of public character, is when we started designing it, we started with the ground floor and went up, but also with housing, the idea was that we start with the interior of the apartment and work outwards. Mm-hmm. There can be a tendency to start with 1-500 massing and do certain views from the street, and then there's a sort of pressure on designers to then squeeze in as many units as possible, right? Which can cause some issues. So here we have sort of coming from two different start from the interior of the apartments and also as a public building.
I know there's a reflexive and necessary way of speaking about architecture as a functional thing to a general audience that serves a certain kind of pragmatic purpose.
Yeah.
But just looking at it from here, there's a lot going on that you might feel like you wouldn't have license to talk about, but to me is totally worth talking about for a moment. And so first of all, so we're looking at the corner, which is like the most expressive or kind of creaturely corner of the building, which has this triangular projection with a circular window at the top. And then the facade facing the street is almost entirely blank, except for the ground floor workshop and one square window on the second floor. And you can see a bit of the silhouettes of the shadows of buildings across the street that kind of play out on this blank concrete facade. And then what's interesting to me is on the ground floor with the workshop, the glazing pushes out almost to the edge of the building, whereas it steps back around the corner. So the workshop's kind of meeting the street really intimately. And then there's this funny thing going on with a pier in between the glazing. The pier is projecting a bit more than everything else. So I think there's something odd about this. There's something that invites you to look again, do a double take, and ask some questions. The other thing is there's another loggia around the back, which is much narrower, which is satisfying some fire escape strategy, I think.
But also it's nice to have a place to step out from your bedroom.
Absolutely.
That's ultimately the reason.
Uh-huh.
But I don't know which bit to address first, but it is addressing fire, and that was one of the first things that we had to address when we were designing housing in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
So from the beginning we did speak with Beryl Menzies, who's a fire consultant, and had really good conversations also about extended family living and why one might want to live in a different way than is usually possible in apartments. And almost the only way that you could really achieve that kind of adaptability and flexibility in an apartment was to have exits from each room, so onto these walkways that both go around to the stair, and that just freed up the plan to be quite different to what you usually get in the UK, with a small internal corridor that eats up a big chunk of your floor plan.
But also, of course, when you're doing an architecture project, every decision has multiple decisions within it, right? So if you're trying to think about housing, you're trying to think about how can you give a kind of variety to the home, in the sense that homes are sort of as units, and they're, you know, they're 21 degrees and they have X amount of this, X amount of that. They're done in a spreadsheet and then they're given a nice facade or whatever you want, not nice facade. And so we're always interested in the idea of kind of depth, sort of constructional depth, right? And what that means is that it becomes one places for the body to occupy. You know, I can sit here, I can sit there different times of day, but also for the eye, right? I think architecture really, at its best, kind of keeps you company somehow, right? And that's because of what you said. You can go back and have a look. It's just maybe we sort of hope the building speaks for itself, because you know, it'd be perfectly possible to speak very eloquently and sensitively about nothing, right? But so we hope that, you know, we don't have to say anything, you know, in a certain sense. The worst way things in a podcast.
It's kind of unreal. Like, it seems like it's not...
Yes,
doesn't,
that's good.
Doesn't quite belong.
No, well, yeah, okay, we'd put it slightly different. What we like is the idea that a building might communicate the sense that it's a model, it's a series of decisions. So if... So how can you say? So...
Well, maybe we could do this. We could look at the buildings beside it for a second first. It's not to critique them, but it's to say that, like most of the city, these buildings are products of regulations, and they're responding to existing constraints, and they're doing it well and fine. And then I think the building in the middle, your building, is understanding constraints but seeking out an alternative within them. And you're talking about models before. Both of you are interested in this theme of models and how, you know, to borrow a phrase from the title of a book you co-edited, we in fact live in models. That the project, the built project, is just the most recent iteration of a model. It's the final model, but it's still in process somehow. And there's this surreal feeling that when you think about architecture that way, everything becomes provisional and changeable. Everything becomes possible again when you think of the built fabric as just a collection of models.
Yeah, but it's also important for the person who lives in it, right? Because then you're not saying this is the final status. I need photos of this thing and they need to be empty, you know. Architecture has to be way more robust than that and way more generous than that. Yeah, I mean, it's the famous point, you know. When you leave the building when it's finished, it's not really finished, right? It's still got its whole life to make itself.
Yeah, I think, what was the term you used? It was like that it's everything's possible or still changeable. I think that's really important to us. And I think we started, even when we were just doing, say, studios at Old Manor Park Library, but that you let people know what's structural and what isn't, so they know what to screw into and what not to screw into. And then you don't have to say very much, because if you've done that, then it's intuitive that you can change it. And it's like an invitation to change it. And you don't have to prescribe the changes.
Yeah, it's to be intuitive, it's very important to us.
It's just that it should speak for itself, and that's the concrete ceilings here, they're left exposed as well. You can see that you can hang things from it, you can join to it. And we gave the residents handbooks as well, where we showed site photos of what's behind the top layer of the build-up, so that they know what's underneath their floor and what's in their walls. And I think housing shouldn't be a mystery, or your home shouldn't be a mystery, where you're knocking on the wall trying to figure it out. Then you should know. But I think there is also another kind of ambiguity in terms of, like, it's not saying that it's housing, and it is, but it could also be a school. Like, the apartments are about the size of a classroom, so you could have a primary school in there, or you could have workshops.
Just to interrupt, one thing's it's kind of what Astrid's saying. This is, you should see her drawings about it. But trying to, there's some problems with the idea of typology, right? And that what lies underneath typology. And so the building's trying to work with that as well. Is there just a city type, you know, potentially, rather than it's a school, it's housing?
That's so true. It's so ambiguous, especially from the street elevation. It almost feels like an institution of some kind. And in fact, its name, A House for Artists, also suggests it's not a typical kind of dwelling. So we're just coming through the courtyard now.
Just go through the ground floor.
Okay. We got a glimpse of the Grayson Perry sculpture, who is an advocate for this scheme. What was his role exactly?
Like you say, he was an advocate, like, which I think is really important with like an unusual scheme.
So we just come into the workshop space now.
And he worked with Create on the selection process for the artists as well.
To help choose the tenants.
Yeah, and how you choose the tenants as well?
It's the ground floor is still a work in progress. So there's two locations the kitchen could go. It seems like the kitchen will stay at the back. They're just planning to put in a kiln and a clay workshop, which we can see. Okay. And at the front, there's no one here now, but we could show you what goes on, but there's all kinds of things like one of the artists in a very straightforward sense will run a life drawing class, or another one of them is working on doing demonstration posters.
And just to paint a picture, there are work desks and chairs and foldable screens and pallets stacked up against the walls and shelves of tools and board games, and it is a community center in a way.
Again, I think the idea is that they have this first, the idea is that there's this first period where it's about figuring out what works with the community and what spaces they want. Then the ground floor is planned in such a way that it's very short spans to have to add walls should you want. So it's kind of clear where the walls can go, but they shouldn't necessarily go everywhere. So it seems like what's going to happen is there'll be one here, and there'll be one there, and there'll probably be another one at the front.
And this is the ceramic space?
Yes, this is the beginning of it, yeah.
And there's the kiln.
Yeah, this is.
Should we go up this
way? Yeah, why not?
Yeah.
Should we walk?
Sure, please.
Oh, do you want to go and see the sculpture?
Sure,
you can take a quick look. It might be dark soon, so.
So we just left the lobby and we're back out in the courtyard now, which is a conventional courtyard, all paved, hard surface, and then there's this eccentric, childlike construction of a house or a series of houses. It looks like it's made of cardboard, but it's probably made of metal. And it's up on this funny kind of flamboyant pedestal. And this is the Grayson Perry piece.
It's his first public sculpture.
Yeah. Really?
I think it's the house he grew up in and his neighbor's house.
It resembles the housing in Dagenham Estate, Beckentry Estate.
Okay.
It's not that, but it recalls it, which is in the same borough and was once the world's biggest council estate. Mm.
And it's an homage to the importance of social housing.
Yeah, to the suburbs, to the semi, to the terrace. You know, that kind of particular type of British life and housing. And yes, it's supposed to look like cardboard, but no, it's metal.
I think it's supposed to look like something that might be in one of these back gardens. Like
right.
That somebody's
like
made
a dollhouse
themselves,
almost.
Like a DIY project. Mm.
There's something very clearly naive about it as a sculpture. And to me, it suggests just how easy this can be. Or how intuitive it is to live well or live comfortably. I mean, aesthetically, it's totally at odds with the building itself, which is incredibly severe by comparison. It's monolithic and massive and angular. But I think the ideas and the aspirations for warmth and conviviality are probably the same, as we'll discover as we go upstairs and walk along these shared outdoor corridors.
I think we were interested in the idea that the building can have the material it has, but can still be light and jolly somehow.
So it could also be stacked children's blocks.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah,
it's quite legible how it's put together. Mm.
So this is, just say this is, it's solid concrete. There's no, it's one continuous piece.
Okay.
But it's also structural, so it's not cladding. Yeah. It's structural, and it's facade, and it's prevention of spread of flames, so it kind of does all those roles.
Yeah, the project originally was a glue lam post and beam module with a precast concrete facade. And then Grenfell happened. It was designed before Grenfell. And in the industry, let's say, there was a sort of sudden lack of confidence in timber, an inappropriate lack of confidence in timber, right? So it became very, very ambiguous as to what the rules were going to become. So the project ended up having to be in completely conventional materials, right? Traditional materials. So the options were steel or concrete or whatever. But that gave an opportunity to kind of actually refine the project, strip it back, try and see what it's really doing. The intriguing thing is once you do that, then you really have to count the amount of carbon per meter squared, right? This suddenly becomes, it grabs your attention more, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, it seems to be a struggle that a lot of architects are facing now between these competing constraints of fire safety and carbon. That timber construction is no longer possible above a certain height in the city, and yet the alternatives are so carbon intensive. But this is concrete that's been mixed with other materials?
It's got GGBS substitute, which it does lower the carbon. It's also kept quite lean. So that's probably the more important thing in terms of besides the concrete that you see, everything else is super light. You know, GGBS isn't the solution for the long run because it actually comes from the steel industry. So it was a response for a particular moment in time rather than what we'd say is the approach we should keep using for the next 20, 30 years.
So should we go upstairs?
Yeah. Should we walk up or go?
Let's walk, yeah. So we've just come in through the lobby and we're walking up through an external stair, which is concrete with aluminium balustrades.
And you can see all the products from the pavers to these. It's all just normal stuff, right?
So it was really important to us that any shared spaces are also places of encounter that are nice to be in, that you might actually stay and chat, like have good light and fresh air. And we're really pleased that the lift lobby has been used for dinner.
Really?
So they,
yeah. In summer.
And it's funny, like you call it a lift lobby, but it's a patio.
Yeah,
it is.
Yeah.
Well, you get a really great view. Yeah.
I think the important thing is when we're talking about the project in the studio, we don't use the term circulation.
Yeah.
There isn't really circulation. There's people's private apartments and there's collective space, and that's it. Because the problem with circulation is it's a monofunctional idea. So in this project, nothing has a monofunction, be it an element or a space, right?
Mm-hmm. So we're standing on the top floor, the fourth floor of the lift lobby, and we're looking out across East London, and there's two possible routes. There's one that wraps around into a very deep balcony or a loggia, and then there's another much narrower route that kind of disappears around a corner. Like, how wide should we go?
Down.
Okay. How wide is this?
It's about 75 centimeters.
Okay. So it's this little catwalk. And then there's a low gate. We can just open?
Yes, open. But I don't know if somebody's in this apartment.
Right,
so.
Okay. This is interesting.
April's not in there.
No?
Yeah.
Yeah, this is the kind of
this is the moment where you have to decide if you're going to, because it's an open walkway, but you're passing someone's back door, I guess. Yeah. And it's almost entirely glazed. So there's a question about when circulating around the building constitutes a kind of trespass.
Because I think it's about sort of respectful negotiation rather than trespassing necessarily, that I think on each floor you'll establish your own patterns of movement.
Yeah.
And I mean, we've talked to all the residents a lot, and like they've only ever said positive things about having a shared terrace.
Yeah.
Like often, you know, that it it's really valuable to them to have that kind of shared space, and that seeing neighbors pass is this kind of feeling of safety. Mm-hmm. And something they enjoy rather than a kind of intrusion. And that might be one of the biggest assumptions that the project challenged, is the sort of British idea of privacy.
Yes.
And the idea that we all really need a lot of privacy. And one resident put it really nicely, that she felt like she'd been fed the lie that she doesn't need community all her life. And that privacy was really important to her, and that she found that she had to give up a tiny amount of privacy to gain this whole new thing that she'd never had, which was a community. And now she feels she has a community.
Mm.
And thinks that's something she was missing out on that might have been useful at other times of her life. And I think that was quite important to us too.
I think the other thing is almost no one has put curtains up.
That is interesting.
Because actually you have to, one, from the street you can't really see, and two, it's actually you have to really want to see inside there to see it, right? Mm-hmm.
And so along this deeper loggia, the flats are almost fully glazed. They look almost like shop fronts with the riser stalls on either side of the door.
The important thing to say is that you get your apartment of a certain size and you get 25% extra outside space. One is really yours because people use it for just stepping up from their bedroom, the back, and this one people really share. And that's very unusual to come to an apartment whereby the largest main living space is located on the shared space.
I mean, it's also quite different to decks in general. Like, decks are usually either quite narrow or quite deep, but almost always you're not allowed to furnish them.
Yes.
So they're never social spaces.
And the concern is that you're obstructing the escape route.
Yeah, usually they are the single route of egress from a fire, and that means you can't furnish them. So that's why having the two sides is really important, because that means you can furnish this one and it is a sociable space.
Mm-hmm.
The other side has to be kept clear.
Right, and it also means you can have more glazing, because as I understand it, if it's a single escape route, then you need much more fire-rated surface.
Yeah, or you can't have any glass for the first 1.1 meters.
Mm-hmm.
So the two-sided nature is important in a lot of different ways.
Mm.
So here the windows start at seat height, so the sills can be seats as well.
Should we sit here? Should we sit? Do you want to sit there?
Yeah, sure.
Got a drink.
Sure, if you're having one.
I'll put the kettle on.
And we're joined by a feline friend.
Daisy.
And in case it wasn't clear, we've just stepped into a resident's flat who's generously given it up for an hour or two while we sit and talk.
I think the thing that's interesting, and you picked up on it at the beginning, I'm not sure if this is interesting for your show, but when you're doing a project like this, you basically have to spend years never speaking about architecture. You have to speak only in terms of why someone's idea or suggestion about adding a corridor or reducing the glazing won't meet guidelines for some reason, right? So you constantly have, you kind of, the building is like a kind of equation with these interrelated parts. And you're constantly saying, well, this equation doesn't work if you change that. And that's the thing that you use to defend it for years. So we've become very focused on that explanation.
The logical argument. For illogical decisions, seemingly illogical decisions.
Well, I think that's completely wrong, actually, because I think the way we do housing majority in Britain is illogical. Mm-hmm. Like, why would you subject people to these bizarre experiments?
Yeah.
So I would say it's logical in the sense that you're trying to make someone's life better. You know, you get a lodger back in front, you have adaptability. And then, yeah, there is a heavy cultural practice component that comes along with that. But I think one goes hand in hand with the other. You can't really have one or the other, right?
Yeah. I mean, I say illogical entirely, facetiously.
No.
Because the logic must be pleasure and delight.
Yes, exactly. The logic for pleasure and
delight. Well-being.
Exactly.
It's so hard to argue for pleasure and delight
and
well-being.
Which is why you don't mention it.
You don't mention it once.
Yeah.
You don't even mention good light or outdoor space. It's really just, you only talk about meeting sufficient light levels or sufficiency. It's really hard to argue for pleasure.
Right.
Or just quality of life.
Be nice.
Bizarrely.
I think it'd be nice if someone...
Take milk?
Black is fine.
Okay.
The best way to see the building is to spend the day here. Or spend it in the morning or afternoon. Because then you see the light changing. And you really get... Sort of, it strikes almost anyone who does that. You sort of get... what the purpose of what the building is somehow, right? Which is pleasure and delight.
Astrid, I'm really interested in this anecdote of this resident who was telling you she felt like she'd been fed this lie about privacy.
Mm-hmm.
How do you go about convincing people that this was a good idea?
We're so concerned about privacy and safety almost to the exclusion of everything else. So as a result, most the typical UK apartment building typology is that you have a long, artificially lit, artificially ventilated corridor with lots of fire doors and some plant room doors, and it's, you know, a hostile space, a really unpleasant space, a sort of also creepy, surreal, weird space that actually people don't feel safe in. We've spoken with other residents where it's like, we used to live in a place like that, I used to just try to get into my house as quickly as possible. It's creepy. And yet that's the what has become established as a kind of norm of safety. And whereas here everyone talks about feeling safe precisely because they feel seen. There's women living alone that feel safe when they come home, that have lived in other places where they wonder if anyone's going to notice if they don't come home at night. Because in most places in the UK, you probably wouldn't know. And then this feeling of being seen, that that no one could go hungry here, that you see your neighbours, it's actually a feeling of safety and
One of the residents said that as well, right? This idea that you're never going to go.
Yeah, that's what one of the residents said as well. And I suppose in terms of convincing people, that's basically quite an unfamiliar idea that you question the very foundation of how most apartment buildings are arranged and say that that's actually not working. And in a way that was possible here precisely because it was for artists. So it gave this, perhaps this Trojan horse to ideas that might be applicable more widely, but it was possible to say so because it was artists. And that applied to quite a few things. Because I think, you know, we can talk about whether it's appropriate to have affordable housing that's specifically for artists, but in this case, it made a lot possible that wouldn't have been possible otherwise, because we were able to talk about things like artists need adaptable homes, they need good ceiling height, they need good daylight, as if this was unique to artists. So it just gave it a license for approaching housing in a different way, which I think now that it exists, we can also say might apply to other people as well.
Mm. I think for us from the beginning, it was the house for everybody. As Astrid Sao, she described it, it was a kind of way in, to question the typology, the dominant typology that's emerged in the UK, a way to unpick that and not do it and start again, like not go with all the assumptions of housing presently, in the majority of housing today.
I wonder if we could go back a bit and talk about the lines that brought you two together and the kind of context around your own work that led to the formation of Apparata as a practice. And Astra, just starting with you, you were an artist before you were an architect.
Well, I mean, we both had an art background and then switched to architecture quite early, but we both studied art first.
I didn't know, Nick, that you were also an art student.
Originally, yeah.
Okay.
And then I switched.
And when did you switch?
First year.
Okay, so there's a difference.
Same first year, I did fine art painting first.
We did 1 year. Uh-huh. And foundation, da da da.
So I just want to get this straight in my mind. So you both just studied art for a year and then around the same time swapped into architecture?
Yeah, but basically.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Okay.
You went to China?
Yeah, I lived in Shanghai for a while.
None of this is on the bios I could find. Yeah, I read that you were a practicing painter in Berlin and a screenwriter. Is that true as well?
I did write a little bit, yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah, you did. She's obsessed with it. She knows how
I find it very interesting. Like, I still find it interesting how stories are structured.
But to this day, you still do basically script consultation work for people.
Well, friends, sometimes.
Yeah. But,
really? Writing for film?
I don't write at the moment. I just find it interesting. And I find it interesting to read about it and think about it.
Mm-hmm. So I'm interested in, I guess, this initial impulse from both of you to pursue a career in art and fine art first, and then this very rapid transition into architectural practice, and what that turning point was. How did that happen? What was the kind of longing you were trying to satisfy in approaching a career in architecture that art itself couldn't achieve?
I think I find constraints interesting. And I think artists have to sort of find their own constraints and set their own constraints to work. And perhaps design and architecture is where you also take other constraints from the world, from the client, from the budget. And I think I find that quite fruitful to think about and try to sort of be in the market, in inverted commas, to sort of work within that to still question the market and what's typically done.
I can definitely attest that Astrid does like to try and figure out this sort of complicated mess of certain type of, like, you have the built environment, these typologies get thrown up, and they're made from a very complicated mix of things. And how do you unpick them and reconstruct them in a way that almost seems unlikely, but for particular ends of having something that is both, like you say, it's more pleasurable to live with, but is more clearly a cultural practice.
But it seems like it was always a really expansive discipline in both their imaginations. Maybe, Nick, it was you who said this in an interview, that as an architectural designer, you can construct things, you construct drawings, you construct models, but you can also construct ideas. And architecture is a way of thinking, a way of seeing that gives shape to how you do things. I believe you should be able to make your way only as a writer and still be considered as an architect. I know this was at the very beginning maybe of your self-formation as a practitioner.
Still believe it.
You still believe it, okay. Absolutely. I couldn't decipher the expression on your face.
Absolutely. No, that's just my face.
It seemed like maybe it was spurious, but I certainly believe in that assertion that it doesn't always need to be buildings.
No.
And yet you have this really concerted belief in the building itself as the communicative object, as the cultural object. Maybe this is actually a good opportunity to now look outward towards influences that have shaped your thinking about architecture, which may themselves not come from the discipline. I know, Nick, you've spoken a lot about Saul Steinberg.
Have I? Yeah.
And the artist duo Fischli and Weiss.
Have I? Okay, yeah.
And I want to talk about them in a moment. But maybe if we start, Astrid, with you. Nick mentioned that you'd written a screenplay in Berlin.
I've never read.
I'm just curious if there is any kind of premonition in the work of writing itself that might anticipate, for example, the project we're sitting in now. I feel like there's always some kind of clue in any creative work that precedes the architectural work. And I'm kind of curious to explore that with you.
Maybe it was like an interest in sort of how people live, perhaps. I'd have to think about that one, whether there's a connection.
I mean, you said you're interested in the way people live, the kind of lives of other people.
Well, or let's say a kind of early experience, which I think was quite influential on me, is also like how my grandma and great aunt lived. Like, they always sort of found a way to sort of have like two apartments in the same building for decades. And it was kind of really normal as a kid to sort of run between these two apartments in the same building. And this was like, they a really sort of happy way of living for them, that they would sort of take turns making lunch, and we'd have these different kinds of places to play in. Like, we'd make stuff with my great aunt, we'd do lots of sewing, and we'd sit and chat with my grandma, and it was these two different spaces in one building. And and it was only sort of in the last 6 months or something that I realized that maybe that actually played quite a big role in how I thought about apartments, that a building might operate as a whole and have different spaces within it, but that you can use all of them, or you can share them, or you can open them up, and that it was a kind of a more complete way of living than having just your little nuclear unit. Mm.
You've written in an editorial recently in The Guardian about how a lot of space standards are predicated on the assumption of a nuclear family, when in fact families expand and contract in myriad ways. And oftentimes people live entirely alone. And so, yeah, what you're describing is like an expanded domain of occupation in a building.
And maybe a bit more porous and flexible.
In that same editorial, you've written that a spare room is often the first line of defense in a crisis, whether personal or global. And of course, COVID really underscored that fact. But I mean, so can a divorce or an aging parent.
Yeah, so many things. Or you think about grown-up children that might have been independent for a while and left for uni, and then they realize that they can't make enough money to live, or they're struggling again. And then if your parents have a spare room, then that can just bridge the gap until you figure things out. I mean, it applies in so many cases. Or somebody's recovering from cancer, but a year later they're on their feet again. It's just that spare bedroom just means people can figure it out within their own friendship and family structures. And it's bizarre that at the same time as cutting spending on social care, you also penalize people for having spare bedrooms, when that spare bedroom could actually, in some cases, save on the social care by having safety nets within people's own networks, that you actually have safety and security through extended family.
Mm. Until I read that in your essay, I hadn't realized there was actually a spare bedroom tax.
Yeah, in social housing.
Uh-huh. That's its informal name.
It's informal name. I think it's not technically a tax. I think it's that you...
But in effect, that's what it amounts
cuts.
To.
Yeah.
I mean, all this is bringing us towards a certain model, maybe, for housing that is different than the one we currently have. And you've referred to it elsewhere as a feminist project, this project, A House for Artists. And I wondered if you could expand a bit on what that means beyond how you've just described it.
I think it is those things, that there's more potential to share or define different structures to live with extended family or share with a neighbor or share childcare with a neighbor. On one of the floors, which we didn't see today, but you can open the doors between apartments, which I think we would happily have done with another family with a child, just to share the load of childcare. And there's also the working from home, that these apartments are intended as places where you can work from home in different ways. So the living rooms are big enough to have space to work from home. COVID showed us that most people were like perching on the side of their bedrooms somewhere, mm-hmm. Because most living rooms, according to normal space standards and normal design approaches, barely have space for a desk even. So there's not even that slightest bit of give. Mm-hmm.
And the reason that extra space is possible isn't because the flats are any bigger than the minimum space standards. It's simply because there are no corridors or hallways.
Exactly. So that's 7 or 8 square meters that you lose to a hallway. You just add that onto the living room. And that means you have space to subdivide the living room as well and make an extra workspace or a more informal division. So there's that working from home aspect, which I think hits women more than men as well, that you that the home can be more ambiguous, more sociable, a place of discourse, encounter, that it's not this thing that's locked away for the man to retire in at the end of the day after he's been out all day. So I think I think that the privacy and the communality aspect comes into it as well.
Mm. It's so exciting to think of feminist architecture as being about where the soft spot in the wall might be to make a new door between flats, or how high the upstand on a window is, or how much glazing, in fact, there is on a front facade. I feel like these types of concerns are entirely architectural and spatial, and yet so obviously social in their consequence. And yet, the discourse of feminist practice and design often seems to ignore these very kind of prosaic questions. And maybe it's an invitation actually to recover a feminism within architectural design itself. I feel that a lot with this project. I feel like a lot of optimism for the kind of discussions it might enable, especially among students. I mean, maybe we could go there. How do you bring these concerns to a student audience, or how do you animate the urgency of these ideas among students?
Maybe it links up a few things you've asked about art practice and what impact that has. And you're saying about certain forms of politically driven critical practice. I guess what we're always trying to do is you're trying to say that we're doing a kind of activism, right? But the activism is entirely expressed and developed through, as you called it, prosaic things, right? The language, the grammar, the output is to do with the things that impact people's material lives.
It's right? Literally, where is the door?
Yeah, literally.
How wide is the walkway?
Exactly.
It's literally that stuff. And it can be, because we've had sort of 40 years of a kind of critical practice schools, right? Which has been very important, right? To completely try and change the curriculum. There probably has to be room for the idea that the actual devices you use to engage in that work can be literally just construction, right? And space and architecture. And I guess that's what we try to do with the students. So it's not this either or, right? It's not either it's architecture as autonomous discipline or it's social practice, you know?
Yeah, I think we let our students work very freely actually in terms of how they like to work. So like we're not opposed to, say, parametricism. If it's a kind of parametricism that's aiming for, it's not just, you know, about certain
formal.
It's not formal, but it's about
complex systems
and trying to understand something. So whatever a student brings to us, I think we're quite open.
Yeah, we like to, in a certain sense, there's a problem with that. So when we initially started, it was still not just us, a whole bunch of people in the same generation were interested in really building things, right? And I think that was a little bit to do with the deficit of the formal education one gets, right? And also the early experience in offices where you're doing illustration rather than construction, right?
You're kind of compensating through practice for a deficit in education.
So that's definitely an issue of the kind of de-skilling of architectural education, and also of younger members of the community, like what their jobs are, right? Simultaneously, at the same time, you have to have, like Astrid's saying, quite a place to think very freely, free of assumptions, or try and break assumptions. And so we're trying to constantly balance those two out, right? Mm. Because if you go straight from just construction, I think that can be very limiting. But equally, if you don't land in, like you say, the width of the door being a political issue, then also it's a little bit useless, the big thinking, potentially.
The width of the walkway is determined by having 20 centimetres for plants, 1.1 metres for access, and 80 centimetres for furniture, which we thought was the minimum to be able to use it really well.
Mm. I mean, something
while sort of still bringing in enough light.
I think something worth saying is something that, can I say, something that drives Astrid mad is double yellow lines. Mm. And this idea of the instruction rather than being intuitive, right?
Yeah, we like instructional spaces in the UK.
Yeah.
We make all our streets instructional.
There's a plethora of line work on British streets.
Yeah.
But in this case, it's about a suggestion or an invitation, but with a high degree of flexibility built in.
Yeah, exactly. A lot of things are made possible. And I think if you go through a process of sort of testing and you make sure that at least sort of 20 different arrangements are possible, then once once you've established that, then it's, you can be fairly sure that even more are possible. And sure enough, we came up with about 10 different kitchen expansion arrangements, but in the house, we've already seen two that we hadn't come up with. So it's, I think it is possible to design in a way that is specific, but still allows a lot of things that you don't expect to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for something to be really flexible and adaptable, the bits that you put in place are important. So I think it's hard to have total flexibility without some kind of framework, but you really have to test that framework quite rigorously,
mm-hmm.
to make sure that people can then use and expand it in their own way.
When you're talking about testing these possible reconfigurations or uses of a space, this is when I start to think about Steinberg. And Nick, what you've referred to in one of your lectures is the deranged order of his drawings. And that word derangement has come up again in that We Live in Models introduction, where at the end of that intro, you've invited the reader onto an airplane and we're ascending into the clouds and we look down onto the city, and you're referring to the deranged order of the termite colony. And I think this kind of insane, crazy abundance of possible ways of living is so exciting and so evident in Steinberg's drawings. Could you talk a bit more about why his work is meaningful to you both, or what you draw from it besides that?
He's an architect who became an artist, right? And then there's also Lino Babadi, who's an architect who became an artist who became an architect who,
yes,
became an artist who became an architect.
Yeah.
And they met each other, as far as we can tell, because they lived in Milan at the same time. And they both have this drawing practice,
mm-hmm.
right? This kind of quite funny drawing, mm-hmm. practice about small observations. I was trying to find one of Astrid's drawings in here, but this one doesn't really have it.
There's something going on there.
Anyway, many are sans rings. Yeah, so I think what's really, I remember Astrid once did a drawing of some plates and on top of plates, and you get ever smaller cups and ever smaller cutlery. And there's something in drawing, you can sort of collapse scale somehow. So the scale of the city and the scale of the tabletop can be the same thing. And it's that kind of quality that really one can get somehow from a Saul Steinberg. On the one hand, you're looking at like a small detail of someone's life, but at the same time, it's a kind of epic scene. It's the other way around. You're looking at an epic scene, but actually it's somehow a strange little moment in life, right? And it's that quality, right, this kind of strange collapse of scale that is intriguing.
And also just critically picking up on the absolute weirdness of what's been established as normal.
Mm, exactly.
And realizing, wow, that's absurd, actually. That thing that everyone says is normal, that's a weird experiment.
Mm-hmm.
And I think quite like that.
Yeah, I think that's it. It's sort of healthy, productive skepticism,
mm-hmm.
and this sort of a humour, one being able to point out the absurdities of life, but also at yourself and what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
That's somehow important. Because also the building, like if you look at the building, I don't think it's a building that, I believe, you know, doesn't take itself too seriously somehow, I hope. Anyway, you can be the judge of that. But for us, that's the quality that Lino Babadi's drawings, Steinberg's drawings have.
Yeah, the creature-like that you said when we were outside. I think maybe that's something from those kinds of drawings as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's interesting that drawing becomes a tool for teasing out these absurdities,
mm-hmm.
the absurdities of the world as it is.
Mm.
And inviting a way of thinking about the world as it could be. It reminds me too of the writer George Perec, who listeners of the show will be familiar with, and links us to practices like 6A and Tom Emerson in particular, who's written about Perec in the past. But I mean, one of my favorite assertions of his, of Perec's, is that we must question our teaspoons, which is so ridiculous on the face of it. But even the smallest quantum of convention stands to be interrogated somehow. And it sounds like for the two of you, that interrogation begins through the drawing.
Yeah, I think so.
I think also, yeah, and conversation. I mean, Douglas will murder me for saying this, maybe don't piss me, but Douglas Murphy will say, hey, you and Astrid, I imagine you two when you're together, you don't really talk much. And it's like, no, it's the opposite. When it's just the two of us, we talk nonstop. And it's an incredible amount of analysis. And then, yeah, the drawings are the way to really kind of really talk about how something, what its strangeness is, or how it might work or how it might not work, right? Just one looking at the time.
Yeah, we have like 5 minutes left, actually. I realize this has been way too short, but also I'm kind of fine with accepting the constraint. Maybe there is one more question or a way to end this interview, and hopefully there'll be many more, is on self-presentation in a way. So Apparata as a practice has reached some kind of transition. It's in a moment where it's receiving more attention following high-profile awards or nominations, whether it's the Sterling Prize you were nominated for or the Neve Brown Award, which you won last year. And I think with that comes more attention and more desire from a public for you to speak on behalf of yourselves and your work. And I'm just interested, at the beginning of the conversation, there's a phrase that came up a few times, which was that the building speaks for itself. And I think a lot of architects would like to think that and have a lot of faith in what architecture can say for and on behalf of itself. And yet at the same time, in this moment of a project being received and in this moment of a practice kind of evolving into a more public role in a way, the architect at the same time must speak on behalf of the building. And I wonder what that transition has been like for the two of you, how you're growing into this role as a more public practice. And I have to caveat that by saying that your website right now has absolutely nothing on it.
Provocatively.
Yeah,
we've not been that good at sort of social media or having a website.
Well, it's because we weren't that interested in it, let's say. I mean, that's not the answer you're looking for, but I guess, I mean, the very direct way, we have decided that we want to write in public on and try and use it as a way to help discourse on certain topics.
Well, I mean, like with the topic of feminism, for me, for us, it was always a feminist project, but I suppose it did occur to me that unless I say so, people might not know. I used to avoid talking in public at all, and now I'm actually trying to do it. Partly because I think it's important that quiet women speak as well, but I think also to talk about these intentions within the building that maybe other people aren't talking about, but that were there and are important.
Every design is making, whoever it is, this design is making a kind of intended or unintended statement about the world. So every building is a kind of, is saying, oh, this is what the city is like, this is what living together is like, right? And people might say, oh, I'm not intending that, but that is what it is, always. But it's definitely the case that we've done a few projects and a few different things, but we've definitely found that it is quite helpful to kind of begin to talk about what is the purpose of these ideas and where they're coming from. No, but we did, like Astrid says, it did occur to us that some things the building cannot say, so you have to say it.
Nick and Astrid, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Scaffold is an Architecture Foundation production. I'm Matthew Blunderfield, and I make the show. The theme music is composed and performed by Luke Blair. Subscribe to Scaffold on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, and follow the show on Twitter and Instagram at @scaffold_podcast. If you like the show, spread the word and leave a rating on iTunes while you're at it. Thanks to Nick and Astrid. Special thanks this week to Lorenzo Iandelli and Jack Swanson. Thanks as always to Scando Lin. And thanks to you for listening. I'll see you next time.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.